Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today's Tuesday. It's December 22. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard, and our first guest is David Rubin. You probably remember him. He's the author of Trump and the Jews, and we've got a lot to talk about because there's a lot of breaking news in Israel with the government. Especially. So first of all, let's say good morning, or rather good afternoon, to David, because I think he's 7 hours ahead of us. How are you, David?
I'm fine. Good to be with you.
It's a pleasure, actually. Well, I want to cover as much as possible because we only have about 20 minutes, and so I don't want to overstep my bounds. One thing that is very relevant, it seems that the government failed to define its budget, and therefore, by not having a budget, the Knesset automatically is disbanded, and there will be another election.
Well, it's not just a question of the budget and defining the budget. The current unity government, you know, has been a two-headed monster. And it's been a government based on combining the left and the right and expecting them to get along, just like throwing them in a closet and saying, okay, you guys, you're going to have to get along. And it hasn't worked. It's been a total disaster for less than a year. And it's really time for elections. I mean, nobody likes to say that. Nobody wanted to have elections. But if the government is non-functional, so people on the left and people on the right and people in the center all agree that new elections are the order of the day. So there are going to be new elections. It's been set now for March 23rd. We're going to see some interesting campaigning coming up in the next few months in Israel.
Okay, so there'll be a lot of horse trading, probably, as they say. Does it look, though, that for the fourth time, a fourth election in March of next year, that we're going to be able to have a majority that's not as fractious or as divided as these past governments have been? Can Israel like that?
It's very hard to know, you know, because you have what we have is a situation where there is now a competition between three or four main parties. Mm-hmm. There's the Likud. And according to the latest polls, the right-of-center Likud has 27 seats out of 120 in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament.
Yeah.
27 seats. Okay, we're going to do a little math now. In order to have a majority government, you have to have 61 seats.
Mm-hmm.
So Likud, according to the polls, and of course that could change in the next few months, Likud has 27 seats. The second party is the breakoff from the Likud, which is called the New Hope Party. And they get 20 seats, according to the polls right now.
4 to 47.
Okay. And then there is the Yamina Party, the more right-wing party. Now, the two parties that I've named so far are right of center, the Likud and the New Hope Party. And Yamina is more right-wing party, and they get 14 seats.
Okay.
So do your math.
61. That's already 61.
Okay, there's already a majority.
Okay.
Now, there are other parties as well, smaller parties.
Yeah.
There's the Yesh Atid Party, which is polling at 13 seats.
Wow.
But they are a left of center party. And then there are two ultra-Orthodox religious parties that are polling 8 and 7%, and then there's an avowedly secular party that's polling at 7%. I meant 7 seats, and then an avowedly secular party that's polling at 7 seats as well, and then a far-left party that's polling at 5 or 6 seats. Now, when you put all that together, what we see is that we have the three main parties are all right of center, according to the polls right now. And if those three parties wanted to get together, technically they could form a government. Now, you notice I just mentioned those three parties. I said Likud, New Hope, and Yamina. But there are individuals at the heads of the parties. So Likud's leader is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yes. Right.
New Hope's leader is Gideon Sar, who is a former leading member of the Likud, and he is on the outs with Netanyahu. Netanyahu does not like Gideon Sar right now because he dared to run against him in the Likud. He lost, but he still dared to run against him. And now he's broken off from Likud, so Netanyahu likes him even less. And then the Yamina Party has at its head Naftali Bennett, who has also had a rough relationship with, an up-and-down relationship. So the question is, will those three individuals, Gideon Sar and Naftali Bennett, and will they get along with, will they be able to make amends with Benjamin Netanyahu and join together to form a governing coalition after the election? Now, that remains to be seen. If those three parties are the leading parties, then they could have a majority just by themselves.
Right. But is there no pragmatism? There's a lot of stuff that's happening. Israel's reaching out. They have just solidified relations with Morocco and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. There's even talk about Saudi Arabia. Even Pakistan is being mentioned. There are broken relations with Lebanon regarding the oil. But is this the time to not be able to come together? Top people in three parties. They need to get together.
You're asking a very good question. And look, we're looking in from the outside. I mean, admittedly, I'm a little bit more on the inside than you are. But looking in from the outside, we're not in those. In the leadership of those parties, and we don't have the personal relationships with each other that they do. So that's the issue. Can they overcome their differences, the personal resentments, to actually join together? Because if they join together, then they, ideologically, there are some differences. Netanyahu is not as right wing as the others. He's more in the center. But ideologically, they could find a way to work together. And politicians usually know how to overcome the personal differences when the time comes to work together. So that may happen. It could very well happen. The other possibilities are that Netanyahu wins and he does what he normally does in his past victories, which is that he tries to form a coalition with the left. And in order to weaken all of his partners in the coalition. So he tries to bring in a left-wing party, and that way he can be the kingmaker, because he is the king. So that that is another possibility that could happen. A third possibility would be that Gideon Sar of New Hope and Naftali Bennett of Yamina join together, form an alliance, and then they would have the largest amounts of seats in the Knesset, and they could appoint the next prime minister, and then they could decide if they want to bring Likud in, or they could join with one of the other center or slightly left of center parties, and they could have their majority. So there are quite a few possibilities here. It's hard to know which way it's going to go, because what we're really talking about is personal versus ideological. What's going to happen here? And the truth is, I mentioned the second possibility, which is that Gideon Sar and Naftali Bennett, you know, of New Hope and Yamina, could join together, form an alliance, and then they could bring in the two ultra-Orthodox religious parties, and then they would have a majority, just that alone, without Netanyahu. So a lot of interesting things can happen. It's really going to play out depending on how they do in the elections, because those numbers that I gave you are just polls as of December 22nd. The election is on March 23rd. And a lot can happen in 3 months.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to ask you about some other things. Morocco worked out an agreement, a rapprochement with Israel. So they're already starting to work together on this. But there seems to be some pushback, because the United States also got involved with recognizing Morocco's claim to the Sahara part of the south
Western
of
Sahara.
Morocco, so they made it one country. But why is there such resentment of Morocco taking sovereignty over that land when it's the Algerians who are the ones that are controlling and undermining Morocco for 40 years? How long does it take for these things to get resolved?
Well,
PLO
sometimes they're not resolved
for 70 years.
Yeah, sometimes they're not resolved.
Exactly.
You know, claims between countries, land claims between conflicting land claims, in this case between two countries, really can go on a very long time. And in this case, it's certainly a question of geopolitics making the decision. And so the Trump administration has given its support to Morocco, and in exchange, Morocco is normalizing relations with Israel and trying to be a more positive partner on geopolitical issues. And who knows, it may work out all for the best. Algeria hasn't been such a good team player, shall we say. So that situation.
Not.
Now, there's an interesting analogy. I don't know if you were going to point it out, but there is an interesting analogy with Israel and the so-called West Bank, Judea and Samaria. Judea and Samaria has long been disputed territory ever since Six-Day War, when Israel took back control of those biblical areas and in 1967, the Six-Day War. And since then, it's been disputed territory, because Israel points to its historical connections to Judea and Samaria, which, by the way, really is the biblical heartland. It has all the historical places that you read about in the Bible. And so Israel says it's ours, it belongs to us. But then you have the Arabs, or the so-called Palestinians, who say, no, this is ours, we're the indigenous people. If you study the history, you see that they're not the indigenous people, but
they claim that's their claim.
Well, that's their claim. So, right. So we have this ongoing dispute. Now I would like to see the Trump administration say it's Israel's historical claim to Judea and Samaria that should be recognized, and we could throw that into the whole deal. But obviously, because the Arab world hasn't accepted Israel's historical claim yet, and Trump is trying to make these peace deals, so he's not willing to take that step as part of as part of the Abraham Accords.
Right. I wanted to ask you, did I remember correctly? There are about 900,000 Moroccan Jews that left Morocco years ago and made Aliyah. They made the pilgrimage to Israel and now residents of Israel. So they're one
absolutely.
Of the largest
hundreds of thousands
of people.
Hundreds of thousands of Jews left Morocco, were expelled from Morocco after Israel's War of Independence in 1948. And they have blended in with the whole country, and they're very productive citizens, there are quite
but
a few generations of Moroccan Jews in Israel today.
Right. So evidently the tourism is going to work, because I understand El Al and Royal Air Maroc are now flying.
There are going to be a lot of flights coming into Israel once we get past this COVID-19 crisis. There are going to be flights coming into Israel from these four Arab countries that have made peace with Israel at this point, and there will be flights going the other way of Israelis going to those countries. There's going to be increased trade. And it's going to be very good for all of our economies.
Evidently. So that's really very exciting. I wanted to celebrate something. There was another group of Ethiopian Jews that have recently, in the last week or two, left from Ethiopia and flew to Israel. And how did that come about?
Well, it's something that has come about over a long period of time.
Yeah.
You know, we have had several large flights, air operations from Ethiopia to Israel, bring Ethiopian Jews, and it's been happening for the past 30 years or so, and it's been happening in stages. And the absorption of them, of the Ethiopian Jews, also has been in stages, but it's been for the most part very successful. There have been issues here and there. There have been challenges, but one thing that we understand is that challenges are there for us. You know, the Almighty gives us challenges in this world. And we're supposed to stand up to those challenges. And mistakes are sometimes made, and that's because we're human. So, I look over there at the United States, you know, which is my native country. I did grow up in the United States, and I'm still very connected. And I see the people who, some of these radical left demonstrators who tear down statues, because they say that those particular individuals or presidents made terrible mistakes in dealing with certain populations. Well, you have to understand things in historical context. Mistakes are made, and a mature person and a good person, a sincere person, contends with those mistakes, improves those mistakes, learns from them, and then does better in the future.
Amazing.
And that's what we've done. That's what we've done in Israel with with the various waves of immigration from the different countries that you have cited.
Absolutely. Very, very laudable, because a lot of countries wouldn't even do that. You know, they wouldn't bring in populations from all over the world, which is interesting.
Well, we're dedicated to it.
Yes, evidently, yes. That's part of the whole concept of bringing Judaism and all the Jews around the world together, at least so we can function together.
That's right.
Because it's good. Well, I see we've already run out of time. It's amazing how quickly it goes. Any last words from you?
Well, I appreciate the interest in Israel and the recognition of the partnership between our two countries. And
yes.
And when every time we speak, I feel that connection even stronger. So
absolutely.
You know, I want to encourage the Americans out there who listen to your show to work towards strengthening that relationship and to always be educated. Be educated about what is really going on. And and they can start by reading my book, Trump and the Jews. Because
absolutely.
That certainly is a great source of information.
Really is. That really did change the demeanor of the entire Middle East, actually, because under Trump's policies, it has changed. It made an unbelievable U-turn, so to speak, for the better, I think. I'm sure the United
absolutely.
Arab Emirates are thrilled.
Let's hope that continues, and that the relationship will be strengthened as time goes on.
Exactly. Well, I don't want to keep you forever. Thank you very, very much. All the best to you. And I hope we'll be speaking again shortly. Be well.
Well, thank you. You too.
Thank you. Okay, well, very good. How exciting to be able to speak to none other than David Rubin. He's the author of Trump and the Jews, as you well know. He's the former mayor of Shiloh, depending on what country you're going to be speaking from. So just very, very compelling individual and very, very much aware of so many things that are happening. We didn't have enough time to talk about the fact that there's the discussion between Israel and Lebanon regarding the oil that's under the water. So Peo evidently is suggesting that if Lebanon and Israel want, he'll be more than happy to mitigate some of these concerns so that a resolution can be found with regard to the oil that is available in the Mediterranean. And it straddles both Israel and Lebanon. And then you also have the Turks who are claiming this, that, or the other, and the Greeks, and it goes on and on and on. And of course, it's Cyprus. But this is huge and worth a fortune of money. And it just speaks well of potential of development, which is what it's all about. I guess everybody's struggling to do that. Okay, let's look at some other things that are pertinent. And let's look at something that you may not have thought of. Evidently, I want to review the Arab Spring, because Biden should learn from the Arab uprising of 10 years ago. It seems 10 years ago, Mohamed Bouazizi, a young Tunisian street vendor, had set himself on fire in a rage at the humiliating harassment by corrupt police. Weeks later, the long tyranny of Zine El Abidine Ben Ali was brought down, setting off a chain reaction of uprisings across the Middle East and North Africa. Hosni Mubarak was toppled in Egypt. So was Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, and eventually Ali Abdullah Saleh in Yemen. And each of these army-backed Arab dictators had been in power for 20 to 40 years. Mass protests in Bahrain were crushed by a Saudi-led intervention. In Syria, the Assad regime waged total war against its own people in a continuing conflict. Only Tunisia has kept aloft some of the soaring hopes of the so-called Arab Spring. But these countries still burst with the yearning of very young populations for decent lives and livelihoods. Uprisings keep recurring from Algeria to Sudan or Iraq to Lebanon. So what does the turmoil of the past decade tell us? The chances of success for Arab democratic revolutions were undermined long before they got underway by the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. This misconceived war removed the tyranny of Saddam Hussein and sought to reshape the Arab world along democratic lines. Instead, by bringing the Shia minority within Islam to power in Iraq, where it is a majority, it reignited the centuries-old conflict between Sunni and Shia and strengthened the messianic Sunni jihadism pioneered by Osama bin Laden, sectarian identity distilled into the brief nightmare of the cross-border ISIS caliphate in Iraq and Syria, has cast a dark shadow ever since, not just in the Middle East, but from Europe to Asia. This boosted paramilitarism as Iran, the main beneficiary of the Iraq war, used Shia militias with missiles to punch a corridor through Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to the Mediterranean and down into the Gulf in Yemen. That, in turn, has sparked regional proxy wars in which Saudi Arabia has championed the Sunni and Iran the Shia. Now, these two theocratic powers are different. The Saudis have for decades spread the bigotry of Wahhabi fundamentalism worldwide, seeding jihadism. But for Arab Democrats, that result is similar. It is very hard to survive this sort of crossfire. And that, in turn, was used to re-legitimize or restore the national security state the Arab uprisings aimed to replace. Gulf monarchies have reinforced theirs, and while loosening social restrictions, brook no political dissidents. Led by Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, they helped restore a strongman state in Egypt through the coup that brought former army chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to power in 2013 after the post-Mubarak interlude. That brief period after the heady Tahrir Square uprising revealed another lesson. Political Islam, as incarnated by the Muslim Brotherhood, is a busted flush. Egyptians narrowly chose Mohamed Morsi as their country's first democratically elected president, bringing the Brotherhood out of the political catacombs. Instead of governing for everyone, they opted to colonize Egypt's institutions, alienating all but their own. The inability to maintain Islamism to find a place among democratic currents is a disaster. Similar issues have arisen in Turkey. There was hope Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Justice and Development Party would be a Muslim analog of Christian Democrats in Europe rather than the neo-Ottoman jingoists they have become. And the failures are a boost to jihadis who say that democracy is not only a dead end but ungodly. Yet the chain of uprisings also revealed fundamental and intrinsic weaknesses in Arab societies and states. Lacking vibrant institutions and a common civic culture, or what the Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam calls the social capital that links people in networks of trust and reciprocity, many in the region have sought refuge in family, clan, sect, and tribe. Again, the exception so far is Tunisia. Tunisia has built institutions, including trade unions, accumulated reforms that provided quality education, greater equity for women, and eased religion out of public life. Ennahda, the Islamist party that polled first in the 2011 elections, stood aside under trade union and civil society pressure in 2013 and now calls itself Muslim Democrats. But that took Tunisia more than a century and a half, and there are no easy or fast solutions. Yet things would change if domestic policies and foreign aid targeted education for these young populations and sought to empower civil society and women. Institution building is critical, yet the West is perniciously attracted to autocrats. The U.S. and its allies often appear to prefer to deal with rulers and regimes focusing on arms and oil. Donald Trump's administration was a prime example. President-elect Joe Biden says this will change, and we shall see. You know, there's a lot of speculation and that sort of stuff. Now let's look at something else that's really quite important. And that is the B117. B117 is what scientists fear is the new variant, which will have already spread worldwide. Well, scientists are scrambling to understand the new coronavirus variant that has devastated the Christmas plans of millions of people in Britain and left the United Kingdom largely isolated from the rest of the world as a result of travel bans imposed by other countries. So we look at what we do and do not know about lineage B117, as researchers are calling it. So where did the new variant come from? It was first detected in mid-October when the COVID-19 Genomics Consortium, the COG UK, read the full genetic code of coronavirus in two samples that had been collected in Kent, the city of Kent and London, on September 20 and September 21. The scientists were surprised to find far more mutations than any previous variant of the SARS-CoV-2 virus analyzed anywhere since the pandemic started. 23 letters of the viral genetic code have changed, of which 17 could alter the behavior of the virus. They include several mutations on the key spike protein it uses to enter human cells. Although no one knows for sure how or even where B117 arose, virologists suspect the mutations occurred in a patient with a severely suppressed immune system who incubated SARS-CoV-2 for many weeks and then infected someone else. They say these conditions are likely to supercharge the mutation process. So how infectious is it, and how far has it spread? Well, B117 has multiplied rapidly in London and Southeast England, supplanting older variants. It was responsible for 28% of infections in London by early November and 62% in the week ending December 9. It also is present at much lower levels in Scotland, Wales, and the rest of England. Computer modeling of the viral spread suggests it is 70% more transmissible than other SARS-CoV-2 strains circulating in the United Kingdom and raises the R value, the average number of people to whom someone with COVID-19 passes the infection, by at least 0.4, making the pandemic far harder to control without stringent lockdown measures. Some specific mutations on B117 also look as though they might make it easier to infect people. Well, but there are no direct lab studies on the transmissibility of the new virus, and some independent experts are skeptical about modeling-based estimates put out by the UK government at the weekend. They say the variant's rapid spread could be at least partly a coincidence because people who happened to be carrying it were behaving in ways that were more likely to transmit the virus, such as ignoring social distancing measures. Well, outside the United Kingdom, the new COVID-19 variant has been identified in Denmark, of which there are 9 cases, Australia, 2, Italy and the Netherlands, each 1. But scientists suspect the virus has spread much further afield than this smattering of cases would indicate. UK is one of the few countries doing the intensive genomic sequencing required to pick up variants. Its scientists have produced half of the publicly released SARS-CoV-2 sequences in the world. There are very few countries that look, and if you don't look for it, you won't find it, said Mads Albertsen, an expert in microbial genetics at Aalborg University in Denmark. I cannot imagine that it hasn't spread worldwide by now. That seems unrealistic. It's been in the UK for so long, it must be in all countries around the world. Will the new variants stop COVID-19 vaccines working? Well, the vaccines completing trials and beginning mass inoculation schemes from Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, and Oxford AstraZeneca achieve protection by training the recipient's immune system to recognize many different sites on the spiral spike protein. So experts do not expect the mutation on B117 to interfere with that. The vaccine, the vaccines induce neutralizing antibodies to several parts of the spike, and most of these windfalls would be unchanged by the mutations, so the variants will still work, said Danish Altman, the professor of immunology at Imperial College in London. Well, the prediction is that the new variant is unlikely to have more than a minor impact on vaccine and effectiveness, agreed Adam Finn, a vaccine specialist at the University of Bristol. Well, scientists at the United Kingdom government's Porton Down Microbiology Labs and colleagues at the vaccine companies are racing to confirm the veracity of that reassuring prediction. Well, one lab test involves infecting human cell cultures with coronavirus and then exposing them to antibodies from people who have been vaccinated. The scientists look for any difference between the ability of the antibodies to neutralize different variants of the virus. Well, in the longer term, researchers will be examining the health records of people who have been vaccinated to find out whether they are more susceptible to some variants than others. And the answers, does the variant offer affect how ill people become if they are infected? Well, the answer here is similar to the question about vaccination and immunity. Quote, there is no evidence at the moment that the new variant causes disease, that the new variant causes disease, which is any different from that caused by previous variants, said Peter Openshaw. He's the professor of experimental medicine at Imperial College in London. There is provisional clinical evidence that B117 is increasing the viral load, the amount of virus present in patients' upper respiratory tract, which is also a feature of another variant called 50V2 that has evolved independently in South Africa. And this rule makes the new variants transmit more readily between people, but it does not it is not clear how the greater viral load would affect symptoms in those who are infected. So very, very important to know. And then we go on to Germany and Switzerland because they have barred flights from South Africa. Well, Germany and Switzerland have banned travel from South Africa after Africa's most industrial nation warned of the emergence of a new coronavirus variant. This variant, which shares some characteristics of a new strain that has appeared in the United Kingdom, has been present in about 9 in 10 new recorded cases in South Africa in recent weeks. This strongly suggests that the current second wave we are experiencing is being driven by these new variants, or by this new variant, said Tsveli Mkhize, South Africa's health minister. The German and Swiss government barred incoming flights from South Africa from the start of yesterday. And the issue, the ban actually aims to prevent the spread of this new variant of the virus, which, according to initial findings, is significantly more contagious than the known form, the Swiss Federal Office of Civil Aviation said late on Sunday. Scientists have yet to determine how the South African variant could be driving more infections, but as with the UK variant, do not believe it is innately more severe. Well, it is still very early, but at this stage, preliminary data suggests that the virus that is more dominating in the second wave is spreading faster than the first wave. It is not clear if the second wave has more or less deaths. In other words, the severity is still very unclear. Said Salim Abdul Karim, an epidemiologist advising South Africa's government. Now, genome data specialists have traced the South African variant origin to Nelson Mandela Bay in the Eastern Cape, the first major metropolitan area to be hit by the country's second wave. South Africa has been recording about 10,000 cases a day in recent days, the highest incidence of cases since the crest of its first wave in August. In the worst hotspots, which include the Eastern Cape and Western Cape, about 1 in 3 tests have been positive, an indication that it is spreading rapidly. Well, the UK and South African variants have emerged independent of each other, but they share a crucial mutation of the spike protein that the coronavirus uses to gain entry in human cells. So scientists in South Africa have said it is very plausible, quote unquote, that this spike mutation, N501Y, may lead to higher rates of infection based on a possible stronger virtual load. But they have cautioned that more study is needed. Overall, there is some evidence that this new variant might be being transmitted more readily than others, although the mechanism of this remains to be fully worked out, said the health department. Well, President Cyril Ramaphosa has imposed tighter national restrictions in recent days, including a longer nighttime curfew and a ban on weekend alcohol sales to control so-called super spreader events, such as festive summer parties. And South Africa's festive season now poses the greatest threat to health and well-being of our nation, he warned this month. So, very, very compelling news. Now, let's look at some other things that that matter. Bear with me a moment. One second. Okay, now, so let me just quickly look here. I'm going to move up to some other sites. Okay, it seems that the first commercial flight between Israel and Morocco has taken off. Since the two countries normalized relations earlier this month, Israeli and American delegations were on board the flight, which is expected to boost business links to the region. So evidently that was successful and very encouraging at that. Now let's look at some other issues. Evidently the United States regrets that Lebanon and Israel are at a stalemate and they offer mediation. Well, it seems U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Tuesday voiced regret over a stalemate in maritime border talks between Israel and Lebanon and offered Washington's mediation. The two nations, which remain technically at war, opened negotiations in October after quiet U.S. diplomacy, keeps seeking to clear the way for offshore oil and gas exploration sought by both. Regrettably, despite goodwill on both sides, the parties remain far apart, said Pompeo, who has 1 month left in office after President Donald Trump's electoral defeat. The United States remains ready to mediate constructive discussions and urges both sides to negotiate based on the respective maritime claims both have previously deposited at the United Nations. Well, the Trump administration has heralded major progress in its waning days in Israel's relations with the Arab world. Since October, four Arab nations have agreed to recognize the Jewish state. The latest session of talks between Israel and Lebanon was put off after the Jewish state accused its neighbor of inconsistency. Well, the two nations have been negotiating based on a map registered with the United Nations in 2011, which shows an 860 square kilometer, which is 330 square mile patch of sea, as being disputed. But Lebanon considers the map to have been based on wrong estimates and now demands an additional 552 square miles of sea farther south, which includes part of Israel's Karish gas field, according to Lebanese energy expert Larry Haitayan. So we're going to have to see how that gets resolved. Assuming it eventually gets resolved, so we'll have to see where that goes. Now let's look at some other things that are happening. Okay. 1 second. This is very, very interesting. And this is with regard to the Kremlin's foe, Navalny, who says that he tricked an agent into revealing that underwear was part of the poison plot that almost killed him. Seems a Kremlin critic, Alexei Navalny, said on Monday he had tricked a Russian secret agent into disclosing details of the botched plot to kill him and had been told that poison had been placed in his underpants. The Kremlin has repeatedly denied that Russia tried to kill Navalny and slapped counter sanctions on the European Union in response to penalties imposed by the bloc. Well, Navalny, one of President Vladimir Putin's most outspoken critics, was airlifted to Germany for treatment in August after collapsing on a plane in Russia. Germany has said he was poisoned with a Soviet-style Novichok nerve agent in an attempt to murder him, an assertion many Western nations accept. Well, the Kremlin has repeatedly denied any suggestion that Russia tried to kill Navalny, announcing Tuesday that it was hitting several European Union representatives with tit-for-tat sanctions in response to penalties imposed by the bloc over Navalny's poisoning. Well, the foreign ministry said that in response to, the foreign ministry said that in response to confrontational EU action, it had decided to expand the list of representatives of European Union member states and institutions who will be denied entry to the Russian Federation. Well, the counter-sanctions were announced after Moscow summoned senior diplomats from Germany, France, and Sweden, where labs concluded that Navalny had been poisoned. German, French, and Swedish representatives were called to the foreign ministry in, quote, connection with the introduction of EU and Russian sanctions, a spokeswoman told Agence France-Presse. Well, the new sanctions came a day after Navalny declared his poisoning case solved earlier this month when a joint media inquiry said it had identified a team of assassins from Russia, FSB, Security Service. In a video published on his website on Monday, Mali said he had phoned up some of his alleged prisoners before the joint investigation was released, and posed as an aide to the Secretary of Russia's Security Council. Now, one of the men named by Navalny as an employee of Russia's FSB Security Service spoke to him for 49 minutes and appears to have been part of the cleanup team. He said Navalny published a recording and transcript of the conversation. Well, Reuters could not independently verify the fact of the phone call or the identity of Navalny's interlocutor. Well, the video clip with the phone call is fake, the FSB said, according to the state TASS news agency, calling Navalny's academy, I guess you could send that by email to whoever's in charge. Now, it seems that Putin last week dismissed foreign minority. Okay, let's see what else is happening on the world stage. Just quickly look here, see if we can cover a lot of stuff. Bear with me a moment. Okay. Okay, so let's just see what we have here next. All right, we'll try see if we can pick up any other news. Bear with me a moment. Okay. Okay. All right, we'll have to see what else is here. I'm looking around to see if there's any more stuff that we could share with you. You know what? In the meantime, while I'm looking, let's play a commercial for you, find out what's happening at the Cabot Creamery, and then we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Well, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Okay, well, welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. My name is Tessie Harris. And let's look at some other things that may be of some interest. Let's quickly look. Of course, I'm sure everybody heard that the Congress, U.S. Congress, has approved a $900 billion COVID-19 relief package. So we'll just have to see how that goes. And we'll see where that lays. One second. All right. Okay, I see it's about 11 o'clock. I don't see that there's that much more news here that we can cover with you. Let me just quickly look to see what's happening in the business world and see if that is something that's changed here. No. Okay. Well, quickly find out what's happening in our neck of the woods, and then we'll be back. And then we'll see if there's anything else to discuss with you. So bear with me a moment. All right, so I think we're fine. Okay. Okay. All right, so I think that things are, well, they're being ratcheted up because there's another wave, maturation and development of a new COVID strain, and so that's very compelling, and we don't have enough people with vaccinations to ward that off. So that's just going to make things more difficult. All right, let's just quickly see what else is happening in our neck of the woods. And I think we're fine. So what we'll do is we'll wish you a good day. Tomorrow's Wednesday, so let me quickly look. I believe that that Gabrielle Emetzel will be on tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And at 11 o'clock, we want to speak to Jonathan Gertman and actually Kenny, I don't know what Kenny's last, and Kenny Plummer. So we'll speak to them about their development in New Rochelle. Very, very exciting, to say the least. And I think you'll find that interesting. Okay. Okay, so we'll have to see how things work. I think what we're going to do is just sign out because I don't see anything else here that we could share with you. I want to thank David Rubin for our discussion. 20 minutes was not enough time, but it's more than I could have hoped for, and that's good. So that's the story at our end. And thank you for being with us, and hope you have a good day, and okay, so I think that's good. All right, so what we'll do now is just simply say goodbye. All right. Okay. All right, let's see what happens here. Okay. I think we're at the end of the line here. We don't have any more news to report. And I guess that'll be it. Can't believe it's only Tuesday. Tomorrow will be Wednesday. There's a lot going on. So let me just go back to our studio screen and make sure we have everything in place. But I'm going to be shutting down in a moment. Got to get back to the studio screen. Bear with me a moment. All right, let's see what we have here. Assuming it went through. Okay, 1 second. All right, let's see. All right, so I'll see what's going on here. Can't seem to find sign out for whatever reason. Okay, should work. All right. Okay. For some reason, it's not working. It's not shutting down. So, just have to figure out a way around this. See which way it goes. All right. Okay. All right. All right, I think we're fine. Just have to say goodbye. And we'll see where that goes. All right, let's just see what we have here. Oh, my goodness. All righty. Okay, so now we were able to shut off. Thanks for being with us today, and hopefully we'll be able to speak to you tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be speaking to Gabrielle M. Edsel from 10 to 11, and that'll be just you and I from 11 to 12, or so I think. I'm just not sure. All right, unbelievable. I guess there's nothing more to wait for here. See, it's 11:03. We're just going to end the episode because I can't find anything else.